So a gay tea room is the English word for a cottage.
Ah, okay.
So you know when the men went cottaging?
Yes.
In England they went to tea rooms, and it's been kept popular in America. And then a Molly House was an actual tea room that gay men could go to and pretend to be...
Molly House?
A Molly House. Now I remember a bar in Manchester called the Molly House just opened, but a Molly House was an actual tea room where the men would go and get dressed up, so it was quite secretive. So that's the tea room. So I was thinking of names on Friday, and they're all a bit long. Loose talk and tea leaves.
What?
Loose talk and tea leaves.
Okay.
Tales from the tea room.
Uh-huh.
I was struggling to get the word gay in there, because you put the word gay there, you lost it. Are we more about academia, so did we need to talk about stories from gay academia?
I was thinking an academic perspective can add another layer to the experience, but I don't think that it needs to be overly academic.
Because I was trying to see what sets us apart from other podcasts. There's two guys at The Fringe who do a podcast, and they record the podcast at The Fringe. One's gay and one's straight, and that's the interaction. And then you've got Homo Sapiens with Will, that seems a similar... a magazine show, almost, because they base it on Woman's Hour.
I think what sets us apart is the ordinary aspects of what we would talk about. We have the nuances of talking about daily life, and I mean, as much as sex is an important part of anyone's lives, really, I don't think that that's what dominates our lives.
Sort of everyday tales.
Yeah, something like that. Everyday tales.
From the tea room.
yes.
Nice tea, by the way, thank you.
Yeah, so something about the ordinariness and the everyday life. And I think for the audience that can be quite surprising, because what they've seen is something more along the lines of like the party aspects, the festive aspects of gay life, like pride, like people wearing rainbows and glitter and dancing and all this sense of party. And that is an aspect of our lives, but it's not what we would offer here. It's something more...
No. With of when the pride finishes and people go home.
Exactly. What happens to all those people that attend the Pride and then they are marching and they are with their friends, and it's all this sense of empowerment and pride and celebration and also demanding our rights, and it's a very intense experience. And then what happens when Pride is over? Where do these people go? Yes.
And that happened to me, because when I was doing Prides a few years ago, there was always a downer I noticed amongst my friends the following week, because we went back to a domestic life. Our shared experience had stopped, so we would go back to work. So there was a sense of depression almost the week afterwards, because we had the euphoric experience over the weekend. But a lot of these Prides are done over a bank holiday weekend. And yes, we'd prepped for it. You know what I mean? We'd tanned, we'd bought special clothes, we'd timed our haircuts. And so then the following week, there was just a real flatness. And I think that's... not that we want to emphasise the flatness, but it's when people go back to their everyday lives.
And that reminds me of something that... I don't know if you identify with this, but sometimes it is the same thrill that happens when you are... when you're about to have a sexual encounter with someone. Mm-hmm. And if you met him via... these dating apps, and then it can be quite intense, and it's, there is some excitement about it, and there is this thrill, this, and then what happens afterwards? So you both go in different ways, and then what's left?
Almost like a Pride is a mass sexual encounter. You know, I don't know, like a sauna almost, isn't it? This mass euphoria.
Well, yeah, if you think about it in psychological terms or psychoanalytical terms, there is this energy of life and there is this energy of
libido
and that is a constructive force, that is something that motivates you and something that makes life thrive. But after that, there is also some... Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if those, again, from a psychological perspective, those prides and those sexual encounters are relationship with other, a shared experience, something that takes you away from relationship with self. But invariably, we have to go back to relationship with self. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our ordinary everyday lives. And then I always say to my clients, bring me the conversations that you have at 2 o'clock in the morning. Because those are relationship with self, isn't it? And maybe that's part of what we're talking about. Those times when there isn't another, almost like a term of reference almost, to be with. And you have to be with yourself. And my mind goes to thinking about when I was in the office.
In the office.
And there was nobody else gay around. It was just a really domestic, open office. And that had a certain flatness to it.
There is something very interesting about what you are saying and coming back to the self. There is this encounter, if you think about pride, and there is all this sense of community and shared space. And for the duration of pride, it's the mass moving as a whole and being one. Something was defined by the collective group, by the collectivity. There was a shared sense of identity. And when that is gone, then it is only you and how you define yourself as a gay person.
It's interesting, my mind goes to two places then, again, as a psychoanalyst. One is shoals of fish. And a fish knows who it is when it's in the shoal. Mm-hmm. And they all swim in the same direction. It's beautifully coordinated, isn't it? You see all these fish darting around, but when it's by itself, it's open, it's vulnerable, and it's disorientated. And then, for the Trekkies out there, I don't think you'll get this, Edgar, but the Borg. Did you ever watch Star Trek?
No.
So the Borg were humanoids that formed colonies like ants, and they were just assigned a number. There was no individuality there, and there was a queen. Interesting cross-reference, but then take a Borg out of the collective and it was again disorientated. It didn't know who it was. It couldn't function. And maybe that's the territory we're doing in this podcast, is we're talking about those times when we are in the collective.
Yes, that's really interesting, because in something that I was talking about in my thesis was this difference between collective identification and a sense of personal identity. And there are things of the collective that you identify with. You have gay culture and you have gay icons and you have gay references, and all these help to define yourself in a way. You can say, well, I like that and I can be part of that. Or you can also use that as a reference for something of what you don't want to be, because probably you want to say, I'm not going to be part of that stereotypical gay culture. But you still use that as a reference to say, I'm not that. So there is that collective sense of belonging or alienation. But you use the collective. Mm-hmm. But then there is a difference between your personal identity, that is, what does it mean, what does being gay mean to you? And that is when people might struggle, because what do you make out of this label? What does being gay mean to you? That is just you, and meanings that you make out of that.
And I wonder if that comes with time and age. I know when I was part of the gay scene, we talked about gay age, and that was different to your chronological age. So your gay age was how long you had been you know, part of that collective.
Oh, I see. I see.
And it, that gave you a sense of maturity. And I think over time you've managed to work out your location in relation to that collective identity. But it takes time. And then my mind goes to thinking about, often on Grindr and whatever, you hear it all the time, the word normal. I'm looking for somebody normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the, and I wonder if that's a discussion around identity, that somehow they're not, they've managed to distance themselves from the collective, but equally they're not part of that heteronormative identity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's settled, it's more processed. So the battle between collective identity and personal identity and internalizing gay.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because it's an acknowledgement of being part of a broader social phenomenon, but at the same time trying to keep your individuality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something quite difficult, because because you, I mean, you want to be an individual and you want to be unique, and you have a sense of, mm-hmm. this is me and I am unique, and but at the same time you are informed by all this normality, mm-hmm. or all these broader social spheres, that it can be, I mean, the gay culture is one, but of course there are other social forces, mm-hmm. like heteronormativity, and that is another one that is quite difficult to escape, mm-hmm. because it's everywhere.
Mm.
So,
and we never exist in one culture. Yes, I'm a gay man, but I'm also,
mm-hmm.
British.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Yorkshireman, first generation university goer, mm-hmm. dyslexic, male, Methodist, Christian, whatever, but all that.
Yes.
So it's all pulling me in different directions and also pushing me into a shape at the same time, isn't it? So it's interesting, I think, particularly girlfriends introduced me, this is Jason, oh, he's gay, so it's my primary identity,
mm-hmm.
that I'm related to, but of course what they miss is all these other forces coming in,
mm-hmm.
and shaping me,
exactly.
as well.
Yeah.
Annoys the heck out of me. Almost desexualizing me. Because I'm always when they've been introduced to a mother or a boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
this is Jason, but he's gay, therefore he's safe. You know, he's safe, he's one of them. But they miss all those other identities.
Which, yeah, that's really interesting, because I remember when I was younger and I would have lots of friends, girlfriends, and they would always get permission to go out because, mm-hmm. it was with me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it was this safety that you, mm-hmm. are talking about. It's, mm-hmm. like also, and their families would love me. I would know their parents. I would know their,
mm-hmm.
and I would feel in a way privileged, because we can have really, really good fun, and
mm-hmm.
but at the same time it is this assumption that,
yeah. Desexualized object.
Yeah.
Almost like, what was it that knows Chinese courts?
And they wouldn't realize that it was even more exciting for them, because sometimes we would go to strip clubs, or they would, so probably we would end up having a wilder night, because it was just, because we would have
the choice of venue.
Exactly.
We're more open.
Yeah. And I would always encourage them. It's,
oh, yeah.
Otherwise you would get all the leaves. I think I'm fine at the moment. Yeah, that sense of freedom. Yeah, and it's interesting, because I would always encourage them, oh yes, go for it, it's...
Your father only knew.
Exactly, yeah.
So, is it worth us slightly introducing ourselves?
Yes.
Just mindful, people might be listening and not knowing who we are, really.
That's
and where
true.
We are and who we are and what we're about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm Edgar. I am a counselor, a researcher on LGBTQ themes, issues, mm-hmm. and I am very interested in the study of gay men's identities and inequalities and ordinary lives. I am based in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I am married to a Scotsman, and and I've been living here for 5 years. Yeah, and that's me.
And that's where we are today.
Oh, yes, we are here at home. We are
in Edgar's apartment, Edgar Neil's apartment.
Yes.
In the lounge.
Having tea.
Tea is going to be very important in this podcast, and today, tea of choice is a very fragrant Earl Grey, served in Edgar's mother's very fancy cup that's quite unusual. I'm Jason. I'm also a counsellor and researcher on, I know Edgar signed in with LGBTQ+. I'm more, I think, solely focused on G. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or not, but it feels prevalent. And I talk about that in my research, how much of my experience that I write about is applicable to other groups within the LGBTQ rainbow of families. My interest is in how gay men treat each other, tensions and problems within gay communities. I trouble the word communities, but gay male populations, particularly friendship groups, when they're also vying for sexual partners. I'm also a imposter / transplant / resident of Edinburgh.
Imposter?
I don't know. Are you ever fully Scottish? I'm a Yorkshireman. Been here 6 years, and Edgar and I have just finished our PhDs at the University
of Edinburgh.
And that's how Edgar and I met. And we have this similar interest in LGBTQ lives beyond what has been written about and spoken about, really. You know, Edgar, I think Edgar put it very eloquently in looking at the everyday, ordinary experiences that sometimes can be quite subtle.
Yes.
But still quite profound. And we hope that you enjoy listening to those or our conversations. And we may bring other people in because we know a few people who are around these issues as well. And it's also worth saying that we're looking to write a book about this.
Yes, we are. Yeah. This is going to be an edited book. Uh-huh. So several authors are going to contribute with a chapter each.
18.
This book is going to address this aspect of everydayness and ordinariness of gay lives. The subtleties, the unexplored areas of our lives, and so we are aiming for next year, 2019.
So if anybody out there would like to contribute to our book,
yes,
let us know. Both Edgar and I work with first person research methods, so it's using the autobiographical as material. I work quite a lot with heuristic research, which uses the body and the emotions and thoughts and feelings as a vehicle for understanding experience and events. And Edgar is interested in autoethnography, which uses...
Autoethnography uses the first person, as in I am, I live, I feel, I experience. It's the from the perspective of the I. I use that experience to relate it to cultural aspects. So it is starting with the self to explore resonances with the culture.
So anybody wants to join us in that, please let us know. And also, if anybody's got a funky title, we're open to a funky title.
For the podcast.
For the podcast.
Okay.
Well, no, for the book as well.
Oh, for the book as well. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
We promise to use it, but if we do, we'll offer you a free bag of tea. Because that seems what we're focused on.
From the East India Company.
From the East India Company in Edinburgh.
That wasn't an advertisement.
No, but we're open to that. So today feels like we're just meandering our way through it a little bit in terms of, and I hope that's okay with you that are listening, in terms of we're just trying to form it. These are conversations that Edgar and I have a lot of the time, isn't it?
Yes.
So we're just letting you sort of be a guest and listen to how Edgar and I talk quite a lot of the time. And also that these are the everyday conversations that I think some gay men are having.
Sometimes these reflections are not shared with anybody, and I think that is also one of the purposes of this podcast, because I've seen in my practice, in my private practice with clients, that sometimes they find it difficult to talk about these issues, and they have them as a private reflection, and then when they talk about it, they feel liberated in a way. A few weeks ago, one of my clients was saying, she's a lesbian woman, and she was saying that she was watching Coronation Street, and or EastEnders, I don't remember if it was EastEnders or Coronation Street, but one of them. And I asked her, I didn't know that you were into soap operas. And she said, well, I am not. I'm really not into soap operas, but I just knew that there was a lesbian couple featuring in the soap opera. Coronation Street. Mm. So and she said, and I felt immediately drawn to watch it. So she's not a fan of the soap opera, and she's not followed the storyline, but she knew that there was this lesbian couple, and she wanted immediately to watch it, because she said that throughout the years, it's always this sense of visibility and representation that she's looking for. She wants to see her life in a way represented. She wants her life to be addressed or to be visible. And I think that relates to many other gay men or trans people or bisexual people. So I think it is one of the common things that we as LGBTQ people might have. Because of course, as you were pointing out just before, each letter of the alphabet, LGBTQ, all of us are quite different. We have many, many particularities in our lives, but we also have some commonalities. And I would say that this sense of wanting our lives to be seen or to have an outlet where we can talk about our lives or in this case a TV show that talks about our lives. I think that's very important.
I was thinking then, and I think that's a really good point, an interesting point, Edgar, is the sense of, for me, when I read a lot about gay men's lives, gay culture, however we term it, the emphasis on sex, the emphasis on HIV and AIDS, and if I go to a gay bar, there's always condoms and lubes available. If I go to an LGBT centre, I'm surrounded by get yourself tested.
Yes.
You know, and the assumption is I'm just fucking from day and night.
Mm. And I mean, those themes are important, but something that I've said, because I've given some talks around these themes, and something that gay men in particular have said, well, are you trying to undermine the importance of sex in our lives? And I've said, no, I think sex is a very important narrative in our lives, an important aspect of our lives, but sex is an incomplete narrative. It is a part of gay men's lives, but it's not the only part.
And that's the same for straight people as well, isn't it?
Of course.
But somehow and I think your research touched on it, what mine did, Edgar, in terms of it's more emphasised, it's more, I can use the wrong word, it's more privileged in gay culture. For me, I work at a practical level around that, and I wonder how much funding for gay men's services still stems from HIV and AIDS, so and sexual health, and how much of that is influencing these agencies' agendas, because they have to do to get money coming in. But hopefully we can offer an alternative LGBT space.
Yes, exactly. We've been mentioning your research, but we haven't really talked about it, so probably we can talk about that a little bit, so the audience has a sense of
the sense.
Yeah.
So my research focuses on and asks questions and is curious around whether groups of gay friends take on characteristics reminiscent of cults. And if the customs and practices that gay men seem to adhere to means they lose a sense of who they are because they don't know what else to do. And within that, then groups of gay friends can become manipulative and damaging. And then what happens to gay men who are then expelled from those groups? If your sense of identity, if your sense of gay identity is so formed around a particular group of people or a particular city's gay scene or gay bars, and you are then expelled from that, what are you left with? How do you deal with that? And that's very similar to people who leave religious cults, that people either leave religious cults because of their own volition, out of their own, not their own choice, but there's a sense of realisation that this isn't healthy, I need to get out of this, or they're forced out because they no longer are useful or beneficial to the group. But a sense of crisis that then goes on within these people as they try to locate themselves without the cult. My research delves into the cult literature, because the cult literature is now beginning to say that we can look at cultic experiences beyond these religious spiritual groups. And I've worked with people, I'm sure you have as well, Edgar, in terms of it feels like the partner we're working with is involved in a very controlling relationship. That they sign themselves in and they spend a lot of the session talking about their partner, and you wonder who they are if that partner wasn't around. And so they give so much, they invest so much of their sense of self into that relationship. And I've seen it with gay friends as well, that they invest their emotional well-being and their gay identity is formed so much within that group.
And I can totally see why, because there is something very important about gay friendships that you cannot cover in other type of friendships. I mean, throughout my life I've had lots of women who have been my friends, and we've had, of course, very, very insightful chats, and but there is something about other gay men that they simply get a lot of the of the experiences, that there is some identification and shared experiences, and you cannot get those anywhere else, because they know, they've been there, they've done that, there is a, they felt the same, and that is really important as a formation of identity, or and not perhaps not necessarily formation, but it's exploration of identity, and I think that is probably one of the reasons why these friendships can be so intense.
And I don't know who said it, maybe you know, a girl, maybe one of our listeners does, but in the sense of, and I can remember the quote, it's something around LGBTQ are more or less the only minority group who don't learn their identity from their parents.
Oh yes, absolutely, there is something, it's, you don't really learn anything about being gay from your parents.
No. And maybe that, does that change? Because I know some gay kids now growing up with gay parents.
Yes.
In modern life. But in generally speaking, broadly speaking, we don't learn our identity from our parents. We learn it very early on from media. Nowadays, the internet. But then the face-to-face interactions either come from sexual encounters early on, but then later on the friendships we form with other gay men.
You also learn from porn.
And I know your research talks about the legacy.
Benjamin Scuglia writes about the importance of porn in the exploration of gay lives and gay men's sexuality, and I hadn't seen it like that, but this very, very, very well-written paper that Scuglia, he mentions that aside from the very rare theatre play or the film, the old film, there is no space where gay men can see their sexual life reflected or celebrated, and that porn has been the only window where we have seen what it's like to be in a celebratory sexual life. So, and of course, that has its implications for how you construct your idea of what it's like to have sexual relationships between gay men. So you can see there are some negative aspects there too, but there is also, like, if it wasn't for porn, then where would we...
And then I'm thinking about, because I talk about my research, Adam Ashaya Green's work, and he talks about sexual capital and how people of a shared sexual identity, when they come together in what he calls fields, he bases on the work of Pierre Bourdieu, they group themselves according to their sexual capital. So an example would be on Grindr, people talk about, I'm looking for friends. I'm looking for friends. Well, if that was the case, he wouldn't give a hoot what they looked like. But they won't talk to you unless they find you sexually attractive. So actually, the gay men's friendships are formed around, or a lot of gay men's friendships are formed around their sexual capital. So the erotic, what you talk about, is interplayed into that. The sexualization of the friendships even occurs. And particularly early on, I think, when you're forming your group, because often those groups, and I think it's nowadays even more so around Grindr, those groups are formed around sexual activity, those dating apps. You know, they don't often come from bars. So I think what you're talking about is the sexualization early on of a gay man's identity through his porn use. But then that legacy is then carried on to his friendships. And so sex is playing either explicit or implicit role in their friendships.
That also has to do with how gayness has been understood throughout the years, because we haven't used the term homosexuality at all during this conversation, but there is this history of the term homosexual that has been used to define this attraction, this desire between men. So if you think about it, for decades and decades, homosexuality was the term that was used to define activities, but it was also to define people, people who would engage in those activities. People would grow up saying, oh, well, I am a homosexual. And the power that words carry in your life is immense. If you grow up defining yourself as a homosexual, or not really defining yourself, because it was a term that was used by the medical community and it has this history of being a pathology. So it has the sexual aspect in the term. It's homosexual. So it is, how wouldn't you expect that someone escapes that narrative if it's just there? It's defining you, and so it's all, what you are is a sexual being. That is really, really terrible.
So beyond the homosexual is what we're sort of talking about. And then my research goes to, and it's early on in the research, but I guess it's a good conversation to have in terms of pride events being reminiscent of religious pilgrimages, thinking about, you know, when people go to the Ganges in India, people go to Saudi, you know, to worship at temples, and how these city centres, you know, over the summer, men, you know, generally wearing quite similar clothing, coming together for mass performance of something. You know, you talked earlier on about the rainbow flags being waved, and you know, similar music and the enchantment of that. So actually, these take on characteristics of pilgrimages.
So where do Where do LGBTQ people go in these pilgrimages, in these pride pilgrimages? What is our Mecca?
I have heard the term gay Mecca mentioned before. But these are the gay quarters, isn't it? These are the Canal Streets, these are the West Ends of Glasgow, these are the Sohos of London.
The gay village in Manchester, the Zona Rosa in Mexico, which is translated as the pink zone. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting how, yeah, these prides normally go to
temples.
To these areas where it's safe.
It's an even sometimes, you know, the gay bars have imagery that could be seen as religious artifacts. You know, they do look like shrines. Picture of a drag queen, picture of Kylie. So that's where my research goes, and is curious around the similarities between cult members and gay men, and where that, and I guess that's what you were saying in terms of where the tension between a collective identity and a personal identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess your research is similar to mine, is where do we locate ourselves on that spectrum?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we have to coexist in both. But certainly for me, there was a time when my collective identity overrode my personal identity.
Mm-hmm. So this is a personal experience.
I think for a time I lost myself somewhere. My sense of well-being, my sense of happiness, my sense of gay identity came from others. And I hadn't internalized that gay identity, maybe that I have done now. So that's, I mean, I always say, you know, having that experience was the best process and the worst process that happened to me at the same time. So I'm not critical of it, but I certainly, when I look at gay men at prides now, I just get a little bit uncomfortable, in the sense of, you know, I see the ones with the sprayed hair and the rainbow flag in,
mm-hmm.
particularly the young men, and I wonder, are they happy doing this? Is this out of choice or out of necessity? And equally, some of the gay men I've worked with, clients, are really struggling with that. They say to me, Jason, it's not me, but I don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where else to go and meet people but the bars, but the apps. And it reminds me of one gay man I worked with, and he said, I'm happy for people to know I'm gay, but I'm not happy for them to know I'm religious. And so he was scared that the fact that he was attending church would have meant he'd be expelled.
Expelled from
the group.
Well, that's interesting, because one of my participants in my study was telling me that that's the point where many of his attempts for a relationship fall apart, because he's a churchgoer. He's a religious person, and that when these potential partners find themselves with this sense of, oh well, this guy is going to church on a Sunday, and that they don't understand that, and it's a clash between their relationship and the religious aspect.
So, probably worth saying, who do you think the audience of this podcast is?
I would say definitely gay men, definitely men who might not identify themselves as gay, but they feel attracted to other men.
Mm-hmm. I think people who are interested in everyday experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of disciplines, I'm thinking counsellors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking LGBT researchers, maybe psychologists, maybe people like us who are counsellors and psychotherapists. And Edgar and I are also interested in creative and relational approaches to research.
Yes.
People interested in queer studies. And people are generally interested in culture.
What about the families of gay men? Could that be an audience too?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because then maybe people's have got a gay child. Maybe somebody's just coming out in a family. Because often families of LGBT people only have the media as well. And sometimes, you know, the gay members have a head start because they've been immersed in it and more exposure to it.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully what we're offering is a more nuanced and multi-dimensional approach to maybe their family members going through at the moment.
Yes.
Not to be taken in by the smiles and maybe the sadness that goes on. So we are aiming for half an hour once a month. We're going to pick different themes.
And probably if there is something that the audience wants to talk about, maybe they can send us a question or a comment to our web pages. So,
And then also we're linking any papers or books that we talk about here.
Yes. Yeah, all the references that we've that we might address during the podcast, we can share them on our web page. So yours is drjasonholmes.com.
And you are
edgarinedinburgh.com.
I'm just going to publicise on Edgar's website. There's a great SoundCloud of a workshop Edgar's recently given on the counselling of gay men, but also some interesting points of discussion that arose from your research, and it's presented in a very, very creative and unusual way. It involves an actor.
Yes, an actor embodying the narratives of my participants. So that is one of just one of the approaches that creative approaches to research.
So please feel free to have a look at both our websites and to follow us on Twitter, and join us in our conversation. Let us know what topics, what comes up for you, what we're saying that's right, what's wrong, and let's go from there.
Let's have a dialogue.
So we'll chat next month with more tea.